Today is December 7th, 2021, and this is Karen Brewster, and here in Fairbanks, Alaska, with Delos Burgraff and her son Al Ketzler Jr., Bear Ketzler, is joining us today. And this is for the Angska Project Jukebox. So thank you both for coming this morning. So just to get started, Delos, can you give me a little bit of your background? And I knew you were living in Nenana. How did you end up in Nenana?
Okay, well, basically,
like, where were you born?
I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and I was a city girl for the first 7 years of my life, learning that world. You learn to cross the street, look, you know, stop on the corner, and you read the red light and the green light, and you learn you don't go into neighbors' yards. You learn that world. And then during that time, the U.S. government drafted my father, who was a man with three children, into the World War II. And his draft was a very different form, in the sense that according to law, a family man with children wasn't drafted. And he got drafted, and so he wrote his senator, Truman, at the time, and asked him, well, why am I getting drafted when under the law that I'm exempted because I have, you know, children? And Truman wrote back and informed him that there is a thing called the Joker in the law, which there really is. I have a black legal law book, which I could show you the law, and it's a joker in the law, means they make laws but don't intend to enforce.
Oh.
That's another little clever congressional gimmick.
Mm.
And most people don't know that.
Yeah.
Well, Charlie learned that early.
So your father was Charlie Purvis?
Charlie Purvis, and my mother is Dorothea Purvis. Both come from agricultural backgrounds, both born in Missouri, but both from different agricultural backgrounds. One, I have no idea in my mother's side, because mom kept very quiet about her childhood, very reserved. And quite often, if I did ask a question, she'd give me some weird little answer that really turned out to not have substance to it. So there's a lot about her I don't know. And with Charlie, was very open about his childhood and very, informative as a child, what his life was like, which was very subsistence farming. No money. I mean, their culture lived without money.
Yeah.
And they didn't need it. But they lived by
17.
Hard work. What's that, hon?
He was the youngest of 17.
Youngest of,
well,
17
he was
children.
The youngest male of 17.
Wow.
He was the 14th of,
wow,
16 children, all birthed at home. And he was, Hera's mom had at least four kids in her 40s.
Wow.
He was at least the second child in her 40s. And then she had two more girls after.
Wow.
So anyhow, it was very rural, what they called in those days Montague Springs. It was southern Missouri, and the irony of them now is probably about 60 miles north of Branson. And Branson begins the region where it's hillbilly country.
Mm.
It is like this.
Hilly.
Yes, and you know, that's the hillbilly country. And I guess the Appalachians were hillbilly country.
Mm-hmm.
You learn to farm on a hillside.
Wow. So,
and Dad's was a little bit north. They had a little more flat land. It was on the Osage River. And he lived, oh God almighty, I mean, his stories, and I could sit here all day and tell you.
I'm
the
sure.
Social system. It was a very, You know, I would say probably about like living in Minto. It was not a community of town, because they were farmers. They mm-hmm. had land, but yet they were very social. And they had the tradition, and somebody's ill, you know, you made sure their cattle got milked and fed and their livestock. And then if somebody is bedfast, they had to sit with them.
Yeah.
And Dad and another teenage young man were at one point when they were teenagers. And I know I wouldn't want this, but if I was bedfast, I wouldn't want a couple of teenagers sitting with me. But they were told to sit with this woman, and she was in a horrible state, just bloated. And they were talking, as teenagers do, that, you know, she's not going to make it, you know, da-da-da. And, of course, time goes by, and she got well.
Oh, good for
her. And got back on her family and all that. Anyway, hon, I mean, there was no doctors. Right. I mean, it life did not depend on a doctor or a dollar.
Right.
And you lived off the land, period.
Sort of like Alaska.
Like Alaska. I mean, I fit like a hand into glove, really.
So did your father come?
Because it wasn't that foreign.
Did your father come up to Alaska through
and
the
so
military?
And so back up, okay, he grew up, and when his dad died, and of course he went to Kansas City, and that's where he met my mom, who at that time was a maid. And she was, according to her story, she was a maid placed in a home so to allow her to go to high school. Now, Charlie only had 5 years of schooling, which was normal in that era. And at that time, for farm boys to get only 5 years of schooling, because they were, by the time they're 12 and 13, they're working like men with their dad on the farm. And the dad said, I'll learn him. You don't need no book to teach him. He'll learn how to work, and he'll learn what to do, you know. And so you do. You work with these adults, and you are learning. Oh, my God, you learn versatile things when you're working on the land.
No, it's just like being a subsistence hunter.
Oh, it
and
is.
Trapper, you
and,
learn
and,
from
and
your
like
elders.
I say, those boys that I, old men that I grew up with, when I come to Nenana, could walk in the woods with just a couple of tools and stay there and come back with snowshoes, a canoe, they could, and then, or skins, and then the women. I mean, when you see the pictures of those people in that era, and those kids are wearing these fur, those women did that. It did not come from Sears and Roebuck.
No.
I mean, I do not, I mean, this irritates me that people don't understand how hard those people worked. There was no leisure time.
No.
There was no leisure time.
No.
And it was hard, physical work. But it was just like my dad's people. It was hard, physical work, sun up to sundown.
Right.
And yes, it was different lifestyle, of course, because up here you can't grow peaches and apples. And oh, my God, did I miss that when I came. And of course, I didn't have a cow in the backyard when I came.
Right. So what year did you come to Alaska?
And I come in 1951. Okay. In December, we crossed the border. And Charlie had been here 2 summers before.
In the military?
No. Okay, I was going to tell you how he got here, because he got drafted. And the U.S. government then contacted him and told him to report to induction in Leavenworth, Kansas. Okay, he's in Kansas City, and he reported to induction, and he knew he was a healthy farm boy, ex-farm boy, and he knew he was going to pass the physical, no problem. And he assumed he would be given 2 weeks to get his personal affairs in order. He was not.
Wow.
He reported to induction, was thrown in a back room, shaved head to toe, thrown in a boxcar with a bunch of other men and sent to Texas for 3 weeks of basic training instead of six, and not allowed to contact his family. He had no idea this was going to happen to him. And the only reason I know this story is that when I'm around 35, I finally remembered when he was in the room with me to chasten him for the way he handled going off to war. Because the way it was presented to me was my mother pulls the blankets off. I'm this little six-year-old kid, just started first grade. And she's crying, "They took your daddy off to war. Get up and go to school. You gotta take your daddy." Anyway, I was aghast because I thought they came in the night and pulled him out. And of course, as a child, of course, I wanted to warn him to watch out for the swords, because Japan was always, you know, in the cartoons, right, they of course made the
mock, samurai,
the mock the Japanese, you know, buck tooth and little eyeglasses, and anyway, with a sword. And so anyhow, I could not warn him. And for a child, that was so horrible. And of course, you're sent to school and you're numb for about 2 or 3 days, and then the teacher shakes you out of it, you know. Shape up, okay, enough, okay. And so you get on with your life. And I never knew until I finally remembered at 35, why did you handle it like this? And he said, "Well, how did she handle it?" And I told him. And then he told me he was not allowed. And he assumed she would think he had taken off to Canada and booked and abandoned. That's what he assumed, she would assume. And he didn't know what she did either. So, but anyway, after he got out of his 2 years of service with the US government, he never trusted the US government again. And he had what today they'd call, you know, the
PTSD.
I wouldn't call it D, but PTS,
okay,
you know? And the same sentence, he would, you know, he didn't like being around groups of people. Anyway, he had to get out to the country. And we got out to the country, was able, then I went to a different world, from the city girl to the farm world. And that was a whole new learning and a world for me. And anyhow, I don't know how to put it. There's a couple of years where he just walked the land. Walk, walk, walk. I mean, just walk all around. It was kind of a remote corner. We didn't have electricity or plumbing. And, telephone. You know, not even the
crank phone?
Crank, yeah. We didn't even have one of them. And that's what everybody else that had a phone that was in the main line, they had. But he had to walk things out and finally kind of, but he did clever things as far as not having any money, as far as he was able to acquire on payment, I'm sure, a chunk of land that nobody else wanted. And it created a very clever subsistence. You caught a couple of goats, and I tell you, goats are the most clever. If you're ever hungry, you go, and you got enough forest or whatever, you go get a couple of goats and you will live. And then a couple of chickens, and then of course you got some cattle. And of course, this was 80 acres of, half of it was, you know, what you'd call pasture, whatever. And then not really pasture, but it could be worked or as a field or grazing. And the other half was, well, a creek and timber, oaks, all kinds of oak, walnut trees, pawpaw trees, hickory nut even. And anyway, it had about four springs on it, mm-hmm. in an area where most people had cisterns. And there was a time when a couple of times we had droughts, and my dad was able to let people who had concerns for their animals come, because we had water.
Mm-hmm.
We had the creek, and then we had springs on that land, and it was perfect land. So I grew up and trained by him, and I loved hunting, and not hunting. I loved the woods. I didn't mm-hmm. love hunting. He taught me to hunt. And I did have to, more than one time when I had to come home from school and go take the 22 out and go. My goal was to get two rabbits or two squirrels. But sometimes you got one rabbit and one squirrel, and then you were in a dilemma. But anyway, after you walk, 3 miles to the country school, one-room country school, and walk 3 miles home, and then you get your little 22, and you go out, and you get dinner, and you peel the rabbit, and you put it on the stove to simmer, and then you go milk the cows, and you this is what you did, and you did the chores, and fed the horses, and the pigs, and all of that. And that was my world until we come to Alaska.
Right, and coming to Nanana,
to Alaska was a 180 degree change.
How old were you when you came to Nanana?
And I just turned 13. And so anyway, I'm planted in a completely different world. And
what was Nanana like? Back then.
And Nanana, and of course Alaska was so different, and it was still on the edge of World War II. The economy in Alaska was still largely subsidized by World War II. The bases, Ladd was still there, Fort Rich was still in Anchorage. There were all over Alaska in a lot of villages what they called CAA in those days, Civil Aeronautics
Administration,
which became FAA.
Right.
And so flying was definitely a norm, which was still novel in Kansas, except unless you were a duster, crop duster, or a performer at fairs, but to get on and jump on a plane was not anything normal. But up here, it was normal. A plane land in a village and people jump on, and of course the ones jumping on normally would be indigenous people, and they traversed in planes
Was the road from Fairbanks to Nanana there yet?
There was no. And when we came in on train from Anchorage. And when you got to Nanana, and I remember the awareness of it. It was like you're in this little island. You're like, instead of an ocean of water, the ocean was forest all around. And here's this little island, and this was this little town, which to me was big time because it was 350 people. And I only had to go about 3 blocks to school, and then school was out, and I could run down to Coggill's store or NC store or Fowler's store. And there was even little May Gilbert, which was Frances Coggill's mother, Jack Coggill's mother-in-law, had a little kind of like a dime store where if you had any loose change, you could buy a trinket or something, And this was, big city. Foreign to around that many people. Yes, I had school friends. When you walked to that 3 miles to school, right. And you know, but that was it. My closest neighbor was, if I went by the road, about a mile and a half, not less than a mile.
Did you have siblings?
And I had two younger sisters. Okay. They were 5 and 6 years younger than me.
And they came with you to Nanana? And, the whole family?
Yeah,
came.
The family came up. And what had happened is Charlie had come up. Like I say, he never trusted the U.S. Right. government again. And then he's always very astute at observing what's coming down the pipe. And he observed this tension in Korea, and of course the MacArthur, all of that. And he knew he was in the reserves, and he knew he'd be one of the first called in. And he knew he had to go somewhere, so that didn't happen. He joined the Merchant Marines. He was able to get in the Merchant Marines. And basically, Charlie, he never formally claimed to be a CO, conscientious objector, mm-hmm. but I know personally he did not believe in it, but yet I know when he got into the World War II, which he was never involved in any, conflict. He was, when they got in, you know, the basic training, 3 weeks, they were put on a troop ship. And it was very grim. All of these men on these huge okay. ships, thousands of men. And they're all grim and serious because they knew they were being sent to the front. And they knew this was not a pleasure cruise. And Charlie said that about midway, there was kind of, and Charlie, this is one of the things he mentioned, and it reminds me of early day Nanana, or Alaska. Mm-hmm. We called it Muckluck Telegraph.
Right.
But on the ship was the same phenomena. Something could happen. And these ships are really huge, long. I don't know how many feet. I don't even know how to begin to narrate mm-hmm. how long a troop ship is. But one information could go quicker than a fire to the other. And like he said, it was all grim. And then all of a sudden was a rumor of a bomb. A rumor of a bomb. And he said then instantaneously the whole demeanor of the ship become a cruise ship. And lounged on the decks and the whole demeanor, you know, of grim men. It was kind of leisure men and joking and laughing men. Totally changed. And they landed, they were the occupation troops, the first ones landed in Tokyo. Mm. And then they heard about the H-bomb. And the H-bomb was, for Charlie, a very demoralizing event because he'd been raised to protect women and children. And his culture was there's different Southern cultures, and I don't know how much you know about Southern cultures. They're, of course, strong Bible Belt, and I'm not talking Roman Catholic, which were suspicious of Roman Catholics. They were agents of the Pope, and they were serious. And they kept kind of rigid notions about how women should behave proper. Mm-hmm. They should be proper. Definitely shouldn't wear lipstick. That made him a little suspicious. Kind Dolly Parton yeah. wanted to grow up to be like.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
Well, I'm going to get you back to Nanana.
Yeah, back to
that.
Well,
so how did you get involved with the early land claims.
But she's got to go back and talk about, you know, Charlie had come up to Alaska, to Nenana,
right,
two summers before to work. He's
yeah.
In the trades, carpentry work.
Mm-hmm. Well, no. So, he wasn't a carpenter yet, hon. He worked in two mines. Hmm. He came up and worked in a mine, one called Jack Wade, I think. Mm-hmm. And then the other one around that Earl Pilgrim, remember mm-hmm. Earl Pilgrim? Mm-hmm.
I know
that. And he worked at his mine. That was the second someone, I think. And that was around Stampede.
Yeah.
And anyhow, that's what, economics is what got him up here.
Mm-hmm.
Back, anyway, he did the merchant marine thing. And then from the merchant marines is how he got to Alaska. He's on the ship, I don't know, crossing, you know, by then you get to know the man a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, he had his adventure with the U.S. government, Tokyo, which was real interesting. And then he ended up in the Philippines. And he had there a picture and saw how the U.S. treated the Filipinos. He didn't like what he saw. He was very shocked. The Japanese were held in high regard by MacArthur. But the Filipinos who had died and fought to protect the U.S. because Japan had come and entered the Philippines and chased MacArthur out. He turned tail and ran and left the Filipinos on the front lines, and they went through brutality.
Yeah.
That you can't imagine. And when Charlie came there, these young children, little boys, had jobs of 50 cents a day or something to gather up bodies and stack them like cordwood that were still laying around. And women were out scratching to get something to eat for their families. And the U.S. government discounted that, just demeaned them. And that irritated Charlie. And I remember his attitude when he, like I say, there's a lot of spiritual consciousness that I was aware of that disturbed Charlie. Exactly what totally alienated him from the U.S. government, I don't know. But I know he never trusted it again.
It sounds like a series of events. All that you've described leading up to it.
Yeah.
Coming to Alaska was a way to get away from that.
And it was in Mexico. If you're alienated from your country, you go to Mexico or Alaska. And he did no Spanish. And anyway, on that troop ship, when he's in the Merchant Marines, not the troop ship, but the Merchant Marine ship, the men get to know each other and start talking. Well, I always want to go to Alaska. Yeah, me too. Well, we ought to go someday. So these four men arranged to buy a car together, and they drove up, Charlie included, and they drive up from, I think, New York. And they have their Alaskan adventure, and they only ended up with three of them arrived because they bought out the interests of one man who had a habit of not paying for any groceries when he's in Canada. And they didn't want to be involved with a crook, you know. So they had to buy his interest out and let him go on his own. And so then the three of them came up. And Charlie, like I say, ended up, I think, on the Jack Wade Creek is how he referred it, as a mining camp. And then went back and proposed to Dorothea, my mom, that we move to Alaska. And she told him where he could take that idea. But the next spring, he's heading north. And she's stuck on the farm alone again, which she hated. Oh,
right.
God, that was horrible for her.
So you guys came up.
He came up again.
It's a wine and Nana.
He came up again by himself, but when he came back that fall, she was packed and had sold out everything.
Right. So why did he pick Nana?
And he came up. And he was in Nenana toward the last Iowa Stampede, as you know.
Oh, right. That would have been close by.
And, of course, it was just the railroad. There was no road in those days. But somehow he ended up in Nenana for a while, and I don't know exactly what he did in Nenana. But he did live there long enough to get involved a little bit with the community and know some of them. And anyhow, he had made arrangements before Dorothea got here for instance, when she come to Nenana, he'd made arrangements with the Coggill store that she could charge food. And, of course, let them know that she would be looking for a place to rent. And he had arranged for a couple, a little elderly couple, to board Mom and us three girls. Now, Mom was very pregnant when she got here. And so we got here in December, and then my brother was born in February.
Oh, she was very pregnant.
So she was quite along. So anyhow, there was three, but nearly four kids. Mm-hmm.
So who did you board with? Do you remember that?
And we boarded with a man who ran and might have even got elected maybe once or twice to the legislature, but back in those days it wasn't a state.
Right.
But they had a pretend legislature, and it was... Oh, my God. His name is Jones. Oh, God. Tom Jones. Okay. Tom and Olive Jones of Nenana. And that's where we boarded. And then Mama found a nice cabin with an indoor pump. We didn't have to haul water. Before, I had to run down past the barn, down the hill, and get a couple of buckets of water. And this one had a pump right in the kitchen. Whoa.
So was Nenana mixed native, non-native?
When Dad would get asked that question, a lot of times, you know, he's talking to somebody, and he always answered, well, it was half native and half white and half and half. That's how he would answer it.
Good answer.
Because there was the real indigenous, right. And then there was the real mixed, and then there were the newcomers like him that hadn't mixed with nothing yet,
right.
You know?
Right.
And then there was some of them that were indigenous, but they were white, and the Coggills.
Right.
And there weren't a lot of the indigenous whites, but, you know, and there were quite a few Canadians. Because in those days, I don't even know if the U.S. and Canada knew that we weren't the Yukon. Because really, son, we used to trade with Hudson Bay.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like there were Border Patrol guys
standing there. And in fact, in charge of the railroad at Nenana, the station master, who was a trustworthy person, I'm sure, was a Canadian or British. I'm not sure if he's British or Canadian. But when the Queen died, their children got dismissed from school to mourn.
Well, at that time, Canada was part of the British Empire.
Yes, that's true. They were still part of the British Empire.
They cared about the Queen.
They did, yes. And they were still part of the British Empire. And like I say, we bought most of our winter gear from Hudson Bay, which was better than Sears and Roebuck.
Huh.
God bless, you cannot know how much better.
Right. And
the U.S. government wouldn't let us do that after World War II. They forced us to buy from Montgomery Ward and Sears and Roebuck.
And so growing up there, well, you were 13, but still, you mixed the natives and the...
Well, our neighborhood, which, unlike I say, Nenana was, what would you call it? There was four blocks up this way and maybe four blocks about that way. And then down on the other side behind was the big barracks. During World War II, they had 300. I've heard there were 350 GIs stationed in Nenana.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And to protect the bridge. They were not there when we came. But the barracks and the mechanisms of running the big barracks, you know, whatever, furnaces and power systems and whatever were still there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think that mechanism was, a lot of your grandma had her children born by those doctors that were in Nenana, I think involved with the military. Now your dad was born in 33 and he's the youngest. It was some kind of federal doctors that your grandma, your dad was born by a doctor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, I mean, is like unheard of.
Well, it was a railroad town.
Or either that or they...
Well, the railroad might have had some
presence there, too, with medical services, Episcopal Church.
No, no, no. This was not the Episcopal Church, I don't think. I know the medical service at the Episcopal Church. Now, the nurse at the Episcopal Church is the one that delivered my brother at home. Mom did not go to Fairbanks to have, it was by the nurse. But I think your mom or your grandma, and it might have been, you know, your Dan was born in 23, your uncle, and your dad was born in 33. In that 10-year time, maybe the federal government had some kind of doctor. You know, they were building the railroad.
Well, the railroad might.
And the bridge was around 1920, you know, maybe it was that.
Because I was saying, Nenana, you know, was a big railroad town, right. And the government
Well, the main purpose of Nenana was the docks.
Right.
That's where the freight come in on the train, and then the freight went down the river.
And the railroad at the time was owned by the federal government, so it would make sense that they would have had a presence there. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the mission would have maybe had a doctor.
I don't think they did not. They might have had doctors sporadically.
Well, that's mean they might have had a visiting doctor.
They did have sometimes a visiting doctor that would come up. And this is the truth.
Right.
Oh, God.
And it shows how things...
Those kids that were a certain age would have to walk down and get their tonsils without anesthetic. Ugh. Now, I never let them touch my kids. You never... He's still got his tonsils.
I still have my tonsils, too.
And so. I mean, I can, you know, oh, my God. I could say, hon, oh, my God. Oh, things that you're just, oh my God.
So in the 1950s, was there starting to be talk in Nenana about land claims?
No. But there was an advocate that we didn't know yet. And he's Tanana. He is Al Starr.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, senior.
That's why the cultural center is made in Nenana, Alfred Scott, senior.
Well, I know
and
his name.
Al Starr, now, hon, do you have a clue how old Al was?
When he died?
When he died, and what year did he die?
Mm-hmm. He died like in, let's see, after Charlie. So it was in the...
Yeah, it was a couple of years, 93 or so.
Somewhere
around
there.
But he was originally from Tanana.
He is Tanana.
But he lived
in Nenana. He's an aristocratic family.
Yeah.
In Tanana, his family, before Fort Gibson,
right.
They were the aristocrats.
Okay.
They were the munitions. They were known in that region for their arrows. They were like the munition manufacturers, and you went there depending on what you were acquiring. And like I say, it was a prominent family, and then of course it became Fort Gibbons, which was occupation troops.
Right. But so he had some inkling. He was sort of the first.
But what happened? Let me tell the story.
Write a book on that.
No. Well, anyway, he was a student in the Tanana school. And my take of it, this is where I'm coming from. That teacher must have seen a quality in him.
This is the mission teacher.
Right. No, no, no. Nah, I don't think it was mission. Well, it could have been.
In Tanana?
Yeah, it had to be.
It had to be.
Yeah, they didn't have a... Well, no, Minto had a BIA school.
Later. But probably not as early as...
Yeah, like I say, I don't know if it's BIA or mission.
I'm thinking with the timing of Al Star being a kid in Tanana, it would have been a mission.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They might have had
a school for the GIs that were there. They might have had families.
Single GIs.
Most of them were in those days. But again, it was a Fort Gibbons.
Right.
So, and I don't know how old, let's see, where said he is 90-something in 91.
Born in the late 1800s.
He is born in very late 1800s. Yeah. Was Fort Gibbons wasn't there yet. Yeah. Or it was there.
It was probably.
Yeah, it was there. Yeah, it was there. So I don't know what kind of schooling, BIA or mission. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling more like government. Well, some kind of government.
One thing I can say...
I don't think Al had influence of any mission. Well, I really don't. I've never seen that in him or his family.
One thing I can say that I don't know if you know, that he wrote sort of a memoir, autobiography.
I'm really glad to hear that.
And it's in the archives.
Oh, wonderful.
It's not...
Okay, we don't need to argue that point.
So we can look that up.
Okay,
You know, it's not a book length. It's, you know, something. But we do have a copy of that. So
I'm glad. But anyway, the point is, and I have no idea how far he was. In school, what, did he go to fifth grade like Charlie? And like a lot of school, BIA schools only went to eighth grade.
Some people only went to third grade.
And some BIA schools only went to sixth grade. And anyhow, so I don't know, but at some quality in him, I need a teacher inform him to get a hold. And I know she was telling it because of Alaska Native Brotherhood, of get a hold of William Paul, Alaska Native Brotherhood. She saw, I am sure. And this is another thing. I want people to never discount their influence. Because that teacher influenced Al. She saw something in him, said contact, and I don't know how the heck that teacher knew about William Paul. Because let me tell you, hon, Texas, I mean, Tlingit country in Tanana was as far away in those days as we are from Africa right now. Yeah. It was really foreign.
Right.
And yet she knew, and she gave him an address to contact.
Hmm.
And he did. And they developed a dialogue, and Al and William Paul started influencing him about claiming land.
Hmm.
Well, Al didn't know whether to believe him or not. And Al, at some young age, as a young man, went, and we don't know how, to Washington State to see for himself if there was, in fact, such a thing as indigenous land being set aside for indigenous. And he had a hell of an adventure out there.
So William,
my guess is he went down probably by steamboat.
Yeah, he would have had to.
He maybe had some money, but he walked back from Washington to Alaska.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, because he had an adventure that I'll tell you about, because he told me it.
But he traveled all over the United States, so too. He just didn't.
I don't know how far he traveled. I know he lived, of course, he wasn't checking into hotels.
No.
Okay. And he, I know, had wonderful dialogues with some blacks that told him exactly how they were treated. And
well, at that point, William Paul was already living in
Seattle.
Now,
he did not go see William Paul. He went to go and see if what William was saying was true.
Okay.
And he did find that truth. He found that. He saw for himself where land was set aside for indigenous. And I don't know how much he traveled or I don't know how long he was there, but I know he walked back because he told me. And one of the reasons he told me the story is, and my guess is he must have been around the Calgary area, which had, you know, that's ranch land,
right?
You know, like Colorado is to the Midway, you know, Calgary. He's walking. Anyway, there's this huge herd of cattle that spot him. Now, cattle, when you're a rancher, they never see a walking man. They only see a horse and a man on horseback. And this critter walking down the middle of the whatever big range that they were on made them curious, and they had to go check it out. And cattle are curious. Mm-hmm. They came up on him, and of course he ain't gonna outrun a herd of cattle. He knew better than to run. They would have just ran after him. Anyway, he kept walking. And then he said it really got scary because they all surrounded him and they sniff him. You know, their little wet noses all wanted to, what is this? And of course, by then he's getting a little bit like, you know, anxiety, I imagine. I can't imagine what it was like. He knew they weren't going to eat him. They weren't like a pack of wolves,
right.
But yet he could get trampled. And I don't know exactly if he walked out of it or if he maybe at some point realized he could scare him off. I don't know, but he narrated that.
That's a that good story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And
but so he came back to Nanana?
And he came back to Alaska.
Yeah, he was out for
quite a while. And Tanana, and told him, we got to do something. We got to do something. We got to set aside our land. And da-da-da, and they were not interested. In fact, he has, during one of his dialogues, he had a niece come up to him and say, Uncle, are you in your right mind? Now, I'm not going to tell her who did that, but to make a long story short, you know, this is something that would hurt a family.
Right.
You know, so I can't tell you the name of the niece, even though I know the name. But this is like, are you crazy?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was so, that's
and
why
so
I was
And so he come to Nenana. I'm in a potlatch in Nenana. I am a kid. I'm a farm girl. I know land is important. And we got to do something. This man gets up and say, and I knew it was Alstar, because I knew him and my dad were kind of friendly. And anyhow, we got to do something about our land. And the people say, oh, shut up. Go sit down. Don't stir up trouble. Go sit down. Don't stir up. And he turned and he dejectedly went and sat back down. And I was baffled by that because to me he was making sense. And I was confused. Why would the people not say, okay, Al, it's great. What can we do? You know, it was like I say, I was sitting there baffled. Well, anyhow.
Do you know why people didn't take up the cause?
Most of it was, I mean, I've heard him as a kid. Mm-hmm. He was still standing up at potlatch just saying that, you know, even the native land claims had already started some momentum, but he would talk about the land. And so at that time, I would just, it was just not to put any attention on the native people, you know, not to.
Not make
upset
waves.
Not make waves, not upset the federal government or the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because in those days, everybody had their systems, and they were pretty locked in. It ain't like free enterprise today,
right,
as we know it.
Right.
So you were, you know, you had to be real careful, because you can be no jobs,
right,
no money.
Yes,
no.
The power relationships between the government and the native people was way different.
Way different.
Back then, yeah.
It wasn't felt before statehood as much. I mean, yes, they had the hunting laws, which was a horrible thing. And a lot of them were not, they enforced, I mean, even under American law, Aboriginal law had paramount.
Mm-hmm.
But they ignored, always ignored Aboriginal rights. and they ignored Aboriginal law.
They being the government.
That was the only whatever.
Right.
And they enforced their own rules. Like, and now I wanted to make a point. First of all, you got to understand when I'm in Enana, it is in 1950s. Mm-hmm. People I'm meeting and talking with and coming to visit my dad were 70 years old. The first whites that come to Enana was only 50 years prior.
Right.
They were adults before the first, and the first white man that came permanently was a man named Jimmy Duke.
Mm-hmm.
Who set up a little store. I think first he had been a roadhouse. Because in those days, the highway was the river, in a way. Mm-hmm. You would have dog trails in the winter on right. the ice, and about, not on the ice, but the trail, right. you know, between.
It was on the ice in some places.
Right, a lot of time. It was between, you know, anyway.
Well, yeah, it would have been to Tanana and Minto.
Uh-huh, right,
that was
exactly.
The main route.
Minto, Nana, and Fairbanks, you know, anyway. But of course, sometimes it'd go over land
and
or whatever and cut, you know, there would be trails and then the river. And usually about every 25 miles would be a roadhouse.
Okay.
Where you pull the team in. The animals were taken care of, and then the men come in, and if they had money, they could buy a meal. If they didn't, they'd buy a place to bunk,
mm-hmm.
unless they wanted to siwash it.
Right.
And so anyhow, that first whites that came were GIs in 1898 to survey.
Mm-hmm.
They did that in Enana. Cannot and begin to guess what the U.S. government had in mind.
Railroad.
I don't know. Maybe
they were just surveying the land.
But they had markers.
Hmm.
We found the markers when when we moved across River Hunt. Hmm. The markers that they had surveyed in. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were stainless steel to make that homestead.
Because for them, they thought it was their land.
Well, I don't know what it was.
They didn't see
American policy.
They didn't
see some of the areas.
No, the villagers. There were three tribes, clans, three major clans in Enana itself, on that junction of uh-huh. the Enana Tanana. The three major clans, the Fishtail, the Caribou Tail, and the Middle Clan, were there. And Chief Thomas was up at Wood River. Chief Thomas was the paramount chief to the people described to me.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the president of the United States.
So he was like...
And of course his jurisdiction was the Tanana, and they met at Luchaloya, which of course whites called Tanana. And the last one meeting they had there when I was in Tanana, for that first chief's reorganizing.
Right, in 62.
In the 62, I met Grandma Ilya, who was in her 90s, who narrated the last meeting that she remembered of the new Chilliwaya. And that is where they congressed.
Right.
They congressed in new Chilliwaya. It wasn't like an every 4 years or whatever. When they called, when the paramount chief would call a congress, a meeting, that's where they'd go. And they would do business, but they'd also do sports and competitions, you know.
Would they do a potlatch?
Everything. It would be days.
Right.
It would, I mean,
so
like...
Chief Thomas was the equivalent of Chief Andrew Isaacs on the other side?
On the other side, maybe more. Maybe
yeah.
more.
Okay.
Because the role... And this is where American law and indigenous law are really different. And that was up here as well as lower 48.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about Hiawatha?
No.
See, that is such a tragedy.
I know the name, but I don't know that I know the story.
He was the great peacemaker.
Oh, right. See, I know
the law of indigenous land, a leader was to maintain peace. Hiawatha had to confront a man who killed three of his kids. And a normal man likes vengeance, but he knew he had to face and make peace. I mean, these were people of power that I don't think the mind of the normal European white man can understand.
No, I would agree with you.
And I mean that was their purpose. Mm-hmm. That was Chief Thomas's purpose. Maintain peace. And you do that, the clans are always have, they're like family quarrels, you gotta. But his job was to make sure they had enough jurisdiction to provide for their families. And if a hunting area got a little sparse over here, maybe somebody would have to let them have a little room here. You know, these management
they were negotiators
of resources. And also, they were given, you know, when you did your fishing or whatever, your chief, this was their bank. Mm-hmm. The chief was the bank. That you had your fish for your year, for your family. But you gave some for the bank. And if there was resources necessary, the chief was in charge of the bank.
Oh, to redistribute.
That was the money. I mean, mm-hmm. as when Alfred Atla, at that, he said, that is our money. And that, I mean, that is the facts.
Right.
That was exactly it. That was their job, was to maintain peace, make sure people had enough to sustain themselves. And
well, that's why I was wondering about the response to Al Starr, whether it was he was stirring things up and...
Okay, let's go. We'll get there. We'll get there. You're getting ahead.
Okay.
You got to understand. Al Starr is on the Yukon River. The Yukon had Sternwheelers 50 years running up and down the Yukon before Nenana. Mm-hmm. The first boat that came up the Tanana was the Tanana Chief.
1898 in August, yeah.
Came up for the first time because it was believed that the Tanana was inhabitable for sternwheelers. First of all, it's very silty, and the sandbars,
it's terrible to navigate.
Terrible, right? They make a sandbar here, and then the next month or week, it's another. Yeah, it's very difficult. And so you cannot imagine. I mean, I can show you a picture, it's a very little picture, of Talbert John, who narrated what it was like when that sternwheeler came up. He was a little boy. Mm-hmm. And the women and the kids were sent out to the woods because, you know, that boat was coming up. They didn't know what's their purpose.
It's a threat, for sure.
And, of course, the men are out front with their bows and arrows to defend. And what is interesting is that Chief Thomas could read.
Oh.
Now, most chiefs and a lot of the people knew five or six languages, okay? And I mean, Chief Thomas apparently probably knew five or six languages because from Nenana, part of their trading expedition was go into Hudson Bay area. You know, that Fort Gibbon. Yukon.
Fort Yukon.
Yeah. And of course, they had a trail over, right. You know, you had that time. And anyway, the captain of the Tanana chief had dialogue with Chief Thomas in the sense that Chief Thomas saw the name Tanana chief, and he told the captain,
on the boat, yeah.
He told the captain, I'm the Tanana chief.
Mm-hmm.
White man be good, Indian be good. White man be bad, Indian be bad. He was
laying down the law.
And they provided for them. They gave them moose meat.
Yeah.
They had, you know, a boat. They had two boats. The Potlatch was named one. The Potlatch had the provisions. And the Tanana chief carried the men. And
the wood, firewood.
Right.
And the wood, right. And anyway, at some point, I think it might have been at Nenana, they lost a big quantity of salt. Because one of the villagers saw that salt, grabbed the sack and hung on to it because it was so valuable.
Yeah, that was valuable.
In those days, interior people, even up until, I think Elizabeth might, no, Tommy Strand was the latest one. They would get goiters from lack of iodine.
Oh.
Iodine. The interior region. Elizabeth had one.
And, it was a hard life living off the land.
It was, you know, and like I say, you know, now they traded, they had arranged trades in some form, because I know in Nenana they traded way before U.S.
No. Yeah, no.
Even before Vitus Bering, I think, for tobacco from
Russia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there were all those coastal.
It was in bricks, you know. And I mean, I know their stories of that training.
Right.
And,
well, I was thinking too, what, you know, Al Starr saying about we need to do something about our land, and the response, the response. But it made me think about was it 1915 when the chiefs met with Judge Wickersham, and they talked about these things.
Now,
and
Judge Wickersham initiated that.
Yeah, but how that trickled down to the response to Al? That why weren't people more receptive?
I don't think they saw the connection.
No, they didn't see the connection. They didn't understand it.
Well, also it had been, you know, a long time.
And then talked about moving them to reservation.
Everybody kind of gives credit to Wickersham, but really who organized the meeting, who would stress that it really needed to be, was a guy named Hudson Stuck.
Right.
Because once they announced they're going to build a railroad, he was from Europe, but he lived in Texas, and he was very familiar with what the indigenous community experienced when the railroad came into California.
Mm-hmm.
It just wiped them out.
It was terrible.
And that's what his vision was. Oh my God, they're going to wipe out all these people. And so he made a plea to Wickersham and other civic leaders at that time, and so that's why it was called. But
and you're right.
The concept of reservations,
right.
That was their solution.
That was their solution.
Yeah,
right.
And that was like, you know, so foreign of an idea.
Well, the chiefs, the leaders who met with Wickersham, they did not want reservations.
No.
They made it very clear.
Well, yeah, they were fine where they were.
They were very smart, and they made it very clear that that was not going to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the records from that.
Right. They were.
Chief Thomas was. The
he
main
was
leader
there.
Of the whole thing.
Yeah. That's why I was wondering if there.
He's probably the one that called all the chiefs to come.
I don't know, and I think Wickersham called it.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying that as far as organization and getting the native community to Fairbanks.
Right.
Didn't they meet
in Fairbanks? Or yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Which leads sort of even in the 50s, when things started coming together with your dad, Al Ketzler Sr., mm-hmm. and Charlie, and you know all those people.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get everybody to come together? Because they were in far-flung communities.
It's a stitch at a time, at a time, at a time. It took months and months and months.
Is it because they were sort of the Potlatch? You knew they had a system?
Okay, Charlie then had met Al. He came up.
Al Starr.
Al Starr was,
I have to
he
make sure
was from Tanana.
Which Al?
He was from Tanana, but he had married a woman from Minchumina.
Okay.
And which had that Minchumina band, most of them had died. And They lived, God, son, you got to help me remember, where did Al Starr live before he came to Nenana?
Well, he lived in Kantishna.
Kantishna, yeah. That's right. Yeah, Kantishna. Yeah, and river. Had how many kids? Let's see, he had Paul, Anna.
Florence.
There was an yeah, one that died.
Florence, yeah.
And he had Florence. He had no a boy that drowned in Enana. Mm-hmm. And Florence. Mm-hmm.
Randy.
Was Randy, I don't think, born yet. I don't think Randy was born yet. But he had these four kids, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Two girls, two boys. And Paul was about 13. These kids had, his family had grown in the Kantishna, mm-hmm. isolated. Very unusual for Native people to live isolated. But her people had died out. They had their hunting and trapping, and they lived off the land their normal way. Mm-hmm. And then Al is the one who wanted them to come to Nenana for education. Mm-hmm. That's why he moved in. Mm-hmm. And it was so hard on them spiritually. And financially and socially and culturally. Because number one, if you remember, Elizabeth did not speak English. And even Nenana women could not speak her Manchumina language. That was hard on her.
So Elizabeth Starr was Al's wife.
Al's wife. And those kids, oh God, oh my goodness. Anyway, it was really hard on them. And I remember Paul, the son. Oh, I don't know how long they'd lived there in Enana. Oh, months. Anyway, he gathered up his little sisters and threw them on a sled, hitched up the dogs, and was heading back to Kantishna all by himself. The kids, they'd had it. It was so hard.
Yeah,
and there was no social help. I mean, that everybody was so isolated and so, you know, you're on your own. There's no resources except your own little unit, mm-hmm. your own family. And like I say, in the meanwhile, it was after that when Charlie and Al started dialoguing. It took a while for them to get settled. I mean, for Al and Elizabeth and the kids to get settled enough to even know Charlie.
So you Al,
know
what he means? Al and your dad
Al Starr and
became acquainted and started
and they
talking.
Become acquainted. I don't know exactly how Al and Charlie, my dad, you know, Al.
I think he was introduced by Chief Alexander Frank.
It could have been Frank. Yeah, Frank, Charlie and Frank. Charlie, right, the chief of Nenana, and my dad had a real tight friendship.
Right.
In fact, they took my dad under his wing, under their wing. He was this poor little white boy bringing up all the... Oh, they were poor.
Yeah.
They were, I mean, God, clothes on our back.
Yeah, it's not unusual that
a
non-native would learn... needed to learn from the natives how to live in a place.
Sure, yeah. Well, Charlie was never white or brown or white. Charlie had dialogue. Charlie also, there's another, I mean, God almighty, we could spend a life talking about Charlie, but I know Charlie at one point was in dialogue with a black man. And the black man was saying something about white men or something, you know. And Charlie says, well, you know, I'm white. And the black man looks at him, Charlie, but you ain't too white. And so, that is Charlie. Charlie was never too white that he couldn't hear somebody who was not.
Right.
He could hear a black man, a brown man, I suppose if a green man showed up, you know.
So
and that is the, so that, he's you know, a
he
rarer
was really
man.
Close to Chief Alexander.
So Chief Alexander was the chief of Nenana.
And
I think, if I remember correctly, you know, the...
That's true.
Charlie recognized, you know, very quickly the injustice to the Native people there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he observed it. The Chamber of Commerce charter belonged to the Chamber of Commerce. Right. Okay, the Nenana Native Council had always sponsored the North American dog races and Nenana dog races. Frank had set out. This is a story you might not know.
So who's Frank?
Frank Alexander, the chief, had set out the cans in the bars, which Nenana at that time had about 13 bars. And you don't remember all of that.
No, I remember seven of them.
And
rough town.
Anyway, it's all along one row and then part down, you know, that one
first
red,
on
you know,
street.
That one, anyway. Anyway, so the bottom line is they put out donation cans in all the bars to donate for prizes for the dog mushers. And, you know, Frank is chief and he goes to gather them up. It's going to get dog racing time. He goes to gather them up. There's no cans. Well, where's the cans? Well, the Chamber of Commerce took them. Well, Charlie over here is going to Chamber of Commerce meetings. And he hears at the meeting that they've got this pot of money. Oh, wow. Charlie, of course, Frank had already gone to Charlie and said, Charlie, why did Chamber of Commerce take our money from the cans? And Charlie said, they did? Well, you know, I don't know. He said, I'll find out. So he goes to the meeting and he hears about this pot of money that Chamber has. And Charlie, of course, he knows where they got it, but he acts, oh, wow, how did we get all this money? How did that happen? Well, they're all trying to kind of stonewall and, well, and, you know, somebody donated it and, well, you know, and they're, you know. So he hears the report of what they say is the amount of money, X amount of dollars, which I can't recall the exact amount. So he lets Frank know how much money they took. And he says, okay, Frank, this is the law. You can say any amount you have, want to, but you go call the law, which he had to call the marshal. Have him come up to your house and report this money is stolen and you want $5,000 back. Now, to make a long story short, Frank let him get off easy. He did not do what Charlie said. He let them return the money to an Indian that they stole. Ooh, they hated Charlie for that. Mm-hmm. Them white boys. Uh-huh. That's the games they played. And that is the truth.
Mm-hmm. And that's...
That
was common.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, just an example.
Just an
It's a good example.
Just of the blatant disregard and disrespect.
If I think Chief Frank told, you know, Charlie, you know, because... The statehood and other things that were being talked about, the land.
Oh, they weren't talking about statehood yet.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Not yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were.
No, they weren't, son. Yeah. You weren't there.
Well, I know I wasn't, but I know when the statehood discussion started.
Statehood discussions were barely there when I married your dad.
Yeah, do you know when they...
I can't remember.
59 is when statehood. Well, I married in 55.
59 is when it was official. 58 was the actual signing. 55 was when they had the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, right. That's when they started, you know, like I say, it wasn't until after that.
But
I think they introduced
the Congress. I mean, I think there may have been chatter.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily
official. It's a very small conduit of people who wanted statehood. There were, most people wanted an independent nation. The United States, would not allow that on the ballot.
Right.
Do you want to be a state or a territory or your own nation?
Right.
They would not allow that question. They only allowed you have a choice, stay a territory or a state.
Yeah.
And a state of 103 million acres out of 365 million.
Right.
Which only is a colony.
Yeah. Well, and you say there may have been mumblings, discussion earlier than 55 amongst, you know, Senator Bartlett and Greening and those
way behind.
Those powers that be.
Politics didn't exist then.
Yeah.
The Republican and Democrat really was so irrelevant to the world.
Well, because we were a territory, so.
In that territory. In the territory.
But there were probably
mumblings. And they just appointed, the governor was appointed by, you know, who the hell is whatever.
By Congress, I think. I
know it was
anyway.
By Congress, but it's a political plum that, or maybe somebody they wanted to get rid of out of D.C.
Yeah.
Maybe they sent them up here.
But so,
you know?
So your dad started getting involved in some of this discussion with Chief Alexander and Al Starr.
And Chief Alexander was not so much a land claim person.
Okay, it was Al Starr.
It was Al Starr.
And your dad started talking and hearing about it.
Well, he researched what Al Starr had, the paperwork that Al had accumulated from, like, William Paul and other responses. Al wrote to anybody who was a dignitary. Al had written to them about this unresolved issue, okay? And like I say, he had a little bag, black bag, he kept under his bed, pulled it out, opened it up to Charlie. He trusted Charlie enough, and Charlie went through that and blew his mind over what really was the facts of Alaska. This is indigenous land, and that the economic system was totally, totally upside down.
Right.
Because then indigenous should have been calling the shots. They could have leased the land, let the people use it, like the railroad, and gotten the remuneration. You know, it could have all been a different story instead of being the beggars.
Right.
And that's how people treated them, like they're somehow. They were called poor.
I know.
I mean, even Emily Tikasuk at the university got really irritated. They kept talking about poor natives at some meeting. And she stood up, what do you mean, poor natives? I mean, hun. These were always efficient. How do you think they survived? When his little grandmother's father was killed by that German down in Nenana River on the whatever, oh God, I don't know exactly.
Cantwell area,
right. Anyway, there were how many, five kids, four or five kids? Fat, healthy, well-clothed, healthy kids. And that man, Nagita, had helped that damn German, who said he was a baron, gave him provisions and even a couple of dogs, which is like me giving you a car,
right,
so he could navigate. And then he come up on him later on. They had stupid German had ate the dogs and was really impoverished, had a very pregnant wife, went to go into, he was mad, he was very angry, I mean, you put it up with these stupid white men, it gets irritating.
No, I agree.
You know, it really does. And apparently, my guess is he was going to open the sled. You know, they had you cover your sled with kind of a tarp or something, so that things stay dry. And when you're driving dogs
and you don't lose
stuff.
Things off the sled.
Well, no, they won't be. But I mean, it's just a protector, and that's also where the kids ride.
Right.
Because the kids are under their safe. Otherwise, your eyes might get poked out.
Yeah.
By a willow.
And
so the kids, everything is not only warm and cozy, but your provisions are protected. And anyhow, he went over and, you know, lifted the flap and probably was going to get something out or whatever. And anyway, this is when the German killed him. Right in front of his family. And your grandma, you know, the story that she told Nora is they were all afraid they were going to get all killed.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. And but those were fat, healthy, well-clothed kids.
It's a terrible history, that relationship, but how non-natives treated them.
And one of the only reason the man was even brought to trial was a minor named Barry. Forced the government.
He went to trial. That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
Time period.
And so anyway,
found not guilty,
of course,
really?
Found not guilty.
God. Well, it's the terrible history, and that's partially, you know, the story of land claims is why part of it's so amazing.
But then again, this is the incongruent part.
Right.
In the 1898. The Tanana chief comes up, all of that. It's like a Martian landing.
Yeah.
Okay.
An invasion.
Transformation. And then about, 5 years later, whatever, that other boat comes up, come to the Chinook people.
Mm-hmm. Captain Madam's boat, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
The one
that came to
Fairboat.
Yeah.
That's the one that claim came.
Right. And those miners, you know, Pedro saw the smoke from the stern wheeler. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the the Tanana chief came up. Then, you know, a few years later, here come another boat. And they couldn't make it,
right.
You know, and they landed. And they, in the Chinook people, is where they banked, like at Nenana was Nenana people. And the Chinook people just kind of went ahead and evaporated and just kind of moved out. Now, some of the Nenana people moved out. Minto went, and more of them moved back down to Minto.
Right.
But then, at the same time, the church came. Not at the same time, but a decade or so later. And made a deal that they would educate, you know, give them education. And, you know, which the Native people wanted education. They wanted to know how is this white man do what he does, you know. And, of course, they didn't know to have control of the curricula.
Right.
Because the church's agenda was to transform them into Episcopalians.
Right.
And the Catholics were to transform them into Catholics. It was not an education.
Right.
It was a transformation that they're going to, okay. And then they made a deal with the church. The indigenous people made the deal with the church to let them have land in exchange for the education.
Right.
And also to provide provisions for the kids when they're in school. Well, that happened, and the nursing happened, and then 19, what year was that flu? Huge flu, which now we know is bird flu. It got identified.
Oh, right, the 1919 epidemic.
Yeah, right. See, well, here in a short period of time, is major things happened, right. That big flu.
It was huge cultural change.
Huge. Yeah. And who nursed them but the nurses?
Those missions.
The missions. There was help. There was, like I say, there was the incongruence. Here is brutality and stupidity over here, and yet over here is comfort and support. Mm-hmm. And then another thing happened, you know, that got over. And then, of course, other things, smallpox, diphtheria, you know, that start hitting here and there. His little aunt got diphtheria. I don't know if you knew that Clara got diphtheria, which is very serious. Yeah. She lived. And then smallpox, and of course, the normal chickenpox, smallpox, that kind of stuff. And then TB.
Right.
All of, you know, just bam, bam, slam on the people, that all people were powerless. I mean, sure, we blame China for whatever, coronavirus, but, you know, they used to call it the Spanish flu, the first one. Bird flu, right. They blame Spain, you know, Spanish flu. So anyhow, all of this, and of course the blame, you know, there's the blame. And who knows? I never heard a native blame the white man for any of the diseases. And in fact, I asked Mita what she thought. She said it come from the ground. To her, it come from the ground. And I was referring to TV. I said, "Well, where did she come from? Somewhere." Anyhow, like I say, the bottom line is the incongruence.
Right.
There was benefits. There was salt.
Right.
There was this. There was that. Flour, and there was danger. Like his uncle told me that one of the early tragic stories was some white men gave, you know, this native man, he handed him this rifle. He said, "Oh, here, you can have it." Well, this man has this rifle. Wow, this magic, you know, wow. And he sees a moose, and he's shooting and shooting, and the moose is not falling. The moose shooting and shooting. And he turned to a kid and pulled the trigger, and the kid drops. It was a .22. Mm-hmm. And a .22 on a moose, it was just go, you know, like right. A bee sting or whatever. Right. And anyway, to make a long story short, these are real things that happened in this social
right.
collision.
Right.
And that is the transforming era. And like I say, I came 50 years.
Right. And you still got to know the elders.
I got to know how they lived before. I got to know and see. And I could say one of my things, I went to my little friend's house. And indigenous love cameras. They love the cameras. And the first thing you do when you went to their house, they show you their pictures. And, you know, my little friends, we go, okay, I'm in their house, and they bring out their photo albums. And I, well, who's that? Oh, that's my uncle. Oh, where's he live? Oh, he died. Oh, who's that? Oh, that's my cousin. Well, where's she live? Oh, she died. Oh, where's my... I am realizing I am seeing only who has survived. Frank Alexander had lost a wife, and he lost his children because he couldn't provide for them. Aklutna took Nina. Two boys got adopted out, and Jenny, the youngest, Nina's sister, got adopted by Grandma Ilya, raised Jenny. And Susie Boatman had lost a husband. And six kids. Oh, Frank, let's see. No, Daisy, the one that Frank married. Daisy had lost a husband and six or eight kids. I mean, like I say, what I saw was what was left.
Right. So.
And I mean, I'm living with people who had insurmountable losses, should have been the bitterest, angriest people on earth. And Frank, you would never have called angry. Mm-hmm. You would never have called Daisy, even though she is a born hunchback.
Mm-hmm. What do you say? That's what the.
I mean, this is where I entered this world and became aware. Holy.
And so that it is. So how is it that they got excited about land claims? Because they weren't angry.
They had so many other problems. Land was hardly relevant. They were trying to survive.
Right.
I was in Minto when. Oh, God, let's see. I was 15, so that would have been 54. I was invited down for the spring. They always in April. Minto
dog
has
races.
Their dog races, right. And we're down there, and it's celebration time, and the village is in the playful mood, and, oh, my God, George Titus and all these, Annie and George, you know, and... all of these people, I am with them, and all of a sudden, here come Fish and Wildlife, here come the plane. It came, it circled, and it landed. Two Fish and Wildlife guys come out, a judge comes out. They set up in the store, which was the village store. They owned the, what you call that kind of store, where they had a loan for it or something. I forget, they had some kind of, I forget the name in those days. They set up court. They called a man in. Your trap, your beaver trap is closer than whatever, 15 feet or whatever. I don't remember the exact dimensions. And the native man, yeah, yeah. All right, $50 fine. So he get in his pocket, he pull out all his money. His brother have to pull out some money, his brother, so he wouldn't go to jail. They call in the next man. Same thing. Next man. They're going down the list, and I'm with Richard. I'm with Arthur, his brother. And I, Arthur, when you go there, you stand mute. You don't say nothing. You just, that means you plead not guilty. You make them prove. You make them go out and prove your trap is closer. You stand mute. Don't say nothing. I'm 15 years old giving legal advice. Because of that damn purpose. Why else would I know it? God knows I didn't learn it in school. Anyhow, he's the only man that did not get his money stolen from him by the government. That's what happened.
Yep.
I came back. It even makes me cry to this day that we, these people went up with. I came back and told my dad that, oh, Charlie had a fit. Oh, Charlie was so mad. I know the name of that judge.
So,
I mean, this happened.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I don't, you know, there's so many stupid things at the...
You know about that one, right?
The duck in.
Yeah, the duck in, yeah.
Well, like one village, like I say, this came out of Tanana Chief story, yeah, and I forget what man told it, but how this one man, and this again is not illegal. When you're, if you were out of a jurisdiction under American law, you had a right to provide for your family. And he had killed a moose out of season.
Out of season.
And it was cold winter. And he is butchering the moose. And a Fish and Wildlife plane land. And he pulled the moose into the cabin. Well, the fish and the plane wouldn't fly or something. And the man, the Fish and Wildlife man, is going to freeze if they don't let him come into a cabin. But if you let him come into the cabin, he'll see the fresh meat. They let that damn man come in, and he arrested them.
And they saved his life by letting him come in a cabin. But so,
and the kids at least ate the moose, but the dad's in jail. So I mean, stories like that.
When did you marry Al Kessler?
I married him in 55.
Okay. And was he already, I mean, I'm going to hopefully talk to him to figure out his story, but he was already involved, the Lankling stuff?
No way. So, he'd come out of the military. He had gotten sent all the way to Fort Rich for his military service, which was foreign country for him. He had never been that. I don't think he'd been to Anchorage before, ever in his life. So I guess you could say it was foreign land.
So how did he end up getting involved? It was kind of going around and Nana?
Well, okay, now you're going to hear how we got educated. Mm-hmm. We got married, and of course, we're going to live happily ever after and have a nice home, and we're going to have nice, beautiful babies, all of that. And like I say, the economy, which we haven't really touched on the transition of American economies. When I first started out, there was still quite a bit of residual government money up here. From the military and building of bases. And remember, they built the dock in Nenana about, 52, mm-hmm. I think. And so money's, then they shut the military down. I think that was around 53. I think that's kind of about the last time, oh my God, when the military would have some very adventurous times for us Nenana people, because they would have, what do you call? Oh, when they pretend to fight.
Like a drill exercise?
No, they have a word for it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's military exercise. They have one army facing the other army.
Yeah, they have a word for it. I can't think of it.
Yeah, I can't think of it. Anyway, the bottom line is they would send down over the hills. You know, here we are in Nenana. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon over the hill would be coming a tank, an army tank, and then another, a weasel. They call mm-hmm. them weasels.
Right. The track vehicles.
And, you know, all, and they'd come across the railroad tracks. They'd march right through Front Street, you know, Hank Street. They'd go down. And then they'd end up out now in those days, where is now the clear site, mm-hmm. and have military maneuvers. That's the word, mm-hmm. military maneuvers. Okay. They would do that. And, your dad was in one of the military maneuvers. Now, he was in Fort Rich, but he was sent up to be the opposing army for the one that was coming in from Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And somehow, anyway, that I do remember him being in the military at that time, and I remember that, you know, us little kids were out. Oh, Al Kessler's in town. And he was in there. And that was one of your favorite stories of when I met your dad, was his adventure during that time. Because him being part Native, he had blood circulation. And these poor little GIs are freezing their feet and everything. And he's saving these guys from, you know, pulling them in and putting them in a warm weasel or whatever to keep them from freezing to death. Well, anyway, he had a lot of stories like that.
I have written here that there was an Alaska Native Brotherhood chapter started in Nenana.
And that's a lot later.
1959.
That is when I'm pregnant with Stephanie. See, that's yours.
Yeah, I have May 1959.
Yeah, that's Stephanie. I was pregnant with her then.
And so did you guys start that chapter?
And that was because the chief at that time of Nenana wanted nothing to do with land claims. So we had to create a vehicle.
Okay.
So that we could invite Kay Hitchcock.
And why did you need to invite Kay Hitchcock?
Because she had written and used as a thesis, I don't remember the title of her, but the point of it was that as long as there is unresolved Aboriginal land in Alaska, land claims, everybody has a cloudy title. Mm-hmm. It's not clear title. So that's why she came down.
Okay, yeah.
To give that talk, and she came down. It was probably November because she was, I think, still a student at the university.
I know she was. She taught English at the university, and I know what you're talking about. What
but
she was becoming.
Wrote. She was still a student, though.
I know, to get
that degree, so she could be a teacher.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
Because she was
about.
Widowed. Her husband had died.
And I know what you're talking about. What's that called? But then there was the Alaska Native Rights Association.
Well, that precedes that, because that the Alaska Native Rights preceded that event, which is a white man's organization. It was up here in Fairbanks.
Oh, okay. Did your dad start that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, him and a couple other people.
Okay.
You know.
And that, what was the purpose of that?
To public education, to get the issue out that there is unresolved Aboriginal, and to educate. It's a public education. And also, you know, any Indigenous that wanted to come. And
so it was a non-Native organization to help educate the non-Native community
to educate, public educate, and I mean Native, white, black, open to anybody.
Right.
In fact, quite often that's how some people heard about it.
Right.
And I know there's other people that heard about it from Charlie that never went to that meeting,
right,
too. I mean, one of them is Al Woods. I mean, he was talking to me how he remembers my dad trying to get him involved, and he acknowledges how uninterested he was, you know. He's kind of, I guess, I don't know what he was doing.
Oh, here, this is Kay's, at least one version of her paper, Natives, Land Rights in the State of Alaska, was something. She was working on a book, so that was later. That was in the 60s. So that was based on her original paper that she did
Could
when
be.
She was a student.
Yeah. Well, anyway, she came down. It was very cold. I still was pregnant. And my guess is because she was a student, it's probably during that Thanksgiving break,
mm-hmm,
to Nenana. And I remember we met in the Native Hall. Alaska Native Brotherhood was given the right to use the Native Hall by the chief, which did not come. He did not come because he did not want to touch land claims.
Well, it wasn't him. I was his wife that was.
Well, it was him. He chewed me. Oh, God, man. There's so much you don't know.
This was Chief Alexander still?
No, no, no. Different chief. I hate to mention that name because it's. Oh, boy. It's one of the biggest clans in the state.
But the chief in Nenana at that time was not interested in land claims.
No.
And so how did you hear about Kay Hitchcock to bring her down?
Well,
to talk?
Like I say, honey, you got to back up. You take too many giant steps, and we're jerking all over. And like I say, I don't even know where your last question was. Oh, okay.
Well, it was sort of getting us into the land claims, period.
But you ought to understand, I could not have done, and Al could not have done land claims if a giant thing didn't happen. in our life.
Okay, and what was that?
And that is we got involved organizing a union.
Okay.
And there is no way on God's earth we ever, ever planned on organizing a union. Things force you to do things. You can either... Anyhow, and he was not technically had to do it because we got married, and before we were married, like I say, I did not have very much schooling because quite often I never went to school till October because I was working.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got in school in October, and I wanted to take accounting, and they offered that course for me, an accounting course in high school in Nenana. And I'm not sure what month it was, but my dad pulled me out of the school because of a comment principal or superintendent or whatever. And anyhow, he said, you get your books and come home. And I didn't argue with him because prior years, I argued with him about having to go to school. I didn't want to go to school. But this time I decided, and I now know it was a sign I was growing up. I decided, okay, I'm in school. I might as well do the best I can. And I was doing very well in school that year. And this here professor made a declaration that just told, when I came home, I laughed and I said, well, Gavin said this about me. And Charlie said, get your books and bring them home. That was it. So I wasn't in school anymore. So anyhow, I was still, I don't know if I'd been writing to your dad at that time. I don't think so. I think I'd gone with your dad a little bit, but then I think I broke up by that time. So anyway, then we got back on New Year's Eve, and then we got married.
So you were young when you got married.
And he had just turned 22, and I was 16. And anyhow, we got married and then went to Ferry for the winter job on the railroad. And that's when he took up accounting with a correspondence course, LaSalle. Correspondence. He didn't complete it, but he came to Nenana, back to Nenana in April. And by that time, the Utana barge lines start getting geared up for the river freight. And they were amused, the Bullock. The president of the company was a woman, and she married a man named Bullock. And Bullock was amused that this young native guy was studying accounting. I hear you're studying accounting. And I remember I was there when he's kind of, you could tell, they're kind of amused at the notion of a native studying accounting. And but they hired him as a bookkeeper, which is a different role than accounting. The bookkeeper gathers data for an accountant. Anyhow, they hired him as bookkeeper in the office of Utana Barge Lines with an increase in salary, which the dock workers, which normally your dad would have been doing, would have been a dock worker. And anyhow, so he's in the office, he's working, with a different pool of people than he normally worked with. Because every summer, I don't know how long it was that your dad worked in the summer, because he was working on the docks, not as a bookkeeper. When we married, he earned his summer money working on the docks, you know, with his brothers and your grandpa, my dad. I all worked on the docks. And anyway, in the fall, okay, we got married. Yeah, that summer, he's working on the docks. And then we moved in the winter and did the study. He came back to Nenana because we were in Ferry. And we come back to Nenana, and that's when they heard that he's studying accounting. So, okay, this is going into, we're not married 2 years yet. We're pregnant with you. And that's when they heard he was studying accounting. So he got hired to be the bookkeeper. And that winter before, not him, he wasn't one of the men that gone to Nenana, I mean to Utana in the fall and inform Nenana, or inform Utana, that they could not work for Utana at those wages anymore, that something would have to be done.
This is with the dock workers.
And this is the dock workers. Had gone to Utana the fall before, which Al, I don't even know if he knew about it yet. I'm really not sure. And I might be getting my sequence a little bit a year off. I'm not sure about that.
But
anyway, that led to this new thing, a union in Nenana, which of course at the headlines in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner was that it was going to be a big problem because the union, whenever you have unions, you got problems. And anyhow, at some point, and I do think I am a year ahead, because your dad left the office, which exempted him from having to be involved in the strike because that was administrative. Mm-hmm. He wasn't a dock worker anymore. But he, at some point, threw his hat in the ring. He quit the bookkeeping, threw his hat in the ring with the dock workers. And I was so impressed with what he did.
Solidarity.
Not solidarity. It was for decent wages.
Well, yeah, but he'd been a dock worker. And,
see, let me back up.
Okay.
The dock wages was $2 an hour, which was not big money, even for that era. Prior to that, you know, during the buildup of the military machines and so forth, they got more money than $2 an hour. That was the difference with working for the railroad, was stability. You got $2 an hour, an 8-hour day, 5 days a week. If you work more than that, you got time and a half, which was $3 an hour, if you work more than 40 hours a week. And you had commissary privileges, and your family got free train rides. If you wanted to go to Fairbanks, you had a pass that you could ride up and down on that train anytime. That was what you got. Well, the government let go of the freighting business, the docks. They let go of it and leased it to this Utana. Now, Utana then hired the men, the same men, at $2 an hour. No other benefits, nothing, $2 an hour. But you were not guaranteed a 40-hour week. You were hired only when the boat came in. When the boat came in, they'd wake you up at 2 in the morning. Al, come on, get up. Boat's in. Gotta load the barge. You'd get up 2 in the morning, work 4 or 5 hours or 10, whatever it took to load the barge, and then the barges would go. And then when the barges come back, you know, like I say, it was no guaranteed 40-hour minimum, and it was still $2 an hour, no fringes. And the men had gone and said, okay, no more. They can't afford to raise a family on that. So your dad went in and joined with the union. And then it didn't take a day or so, but my little cabin became union headquarters. And the cabin was probably about as big as this room, a little bit bigger than this room. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
What is that? How many square feet? 600 square feet?
Oh, no. Probably about 350.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm involved. Anyhow, they met and strategized and wrote letters. And anyhow, at some point, then your dad got voted to be the negotiator. Him and Hug Fredericks and Quentin Qualley would meet. And these Utanim board were, hon, maybe this is where it should come to your dad to talk about it, but he would, they negotiated a while, well then they wouldn't negotiate anymore, Qualley was there. So Qualley had to resign, and that left Hug and your dad. And then Hug personally resigned because he couldn't stand the stress. And it left your dad alone. I think Utana had 7 lawyers plus the board. And they would say things like, you goddamn Indians, you know you're going to just drink the money up. And your dad took shit like that, Bear.
I know he did, yeah.
To this day. I mean, your dad was not that kind of person. I mean, for your dad to have to come home and take shit like that. I mean, I don't understand human beings.
No.
I don't. Yeah, you can step on somebody, but if you're a human being, you don't step on somebody. And of course, the irony is, your dad started drinking. And of course, that's a double hurt for me, because that means the son of a bitch just won.
Mm-hmm. Just the furnace just went on, I think.
Yeah, that's a furnace.
Is it the furnace?
Or the water pump. It might be the water pump.
Okay.
Yeah, not the house ain't going to blow up.
No. It's just the noise on the recording is all I'm saying. I'm just explaining the background noise that all
so
of a sudden.
So anyhow.
Yeah, they physically.
It took 3 years.
So, I'm sorry, Bear, they physically beat up your uncles? Is that what you said?
They took him into the
back. Well, that's another part of the story. That's right. He was my brother-in-law, was elected presider of this little union. Oh, God, now I forget what sequence that was. I think that was. I think I do have the sequence wrong. Number one. Married your dad in 55. The union, your dad worked the dock that whole summer. Mm-hmm. And then it was, no.
It don't matter. I mean,
well, it does in a way because, okay.
I can get the dates.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you should word. Talk to your dad
yeah,
anyway.
I'll talk to him.
Why don't you talk
yeah,
to him?
I hope
anyway,
to.
It is this experience
right.
that we went through.
Right.
And I mean, I learned so much.
Right. That's what I'm more interested in hearing about the experience
at,
than the dates.
Yeah.
At dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
The internal dynamics of the union people,
mm-hmm.
the outside dynamics, you know, it's like ping pong, you know, pool table, you know. There's a set of balls and there's that pow, and the impact of the balls and the dynamic and that ball hits that ball and that ball. And anyhow, this is just that Nenana become this pool table. The balls get hit. Some go into the pocket and disappear, and then maybe new balls get thrown up. But anyhow, I learned about dynamics, the internal, the external. And if I had not had that, I could not have done land claims. I could not have done land claims if I had not had that education. And it was a 3-year intense education. 3 years.
3 years for the union effort?
Before we won.
Wow.
And anyhow, it's a long story. But anyhow, if I had not had that, well, needless to say, your dad had had enough. He ended up, of course, getting employed at the FAA. For him, that was like dying and going to heaven, a steady year-round job, not just summer job, year-round job. And by that time, he had 4 kids. And officially, even though he'd gone through a whole lot of education, still 7 years of school, even though both of us ought to have some kind of at least associate degree in something.
Yeah.
But
in life,
anyhow.
In life experience.
Yeah. Anyhow, he got that job. Okay. But, and like I say, he wanted nothing to do with land claims. Not so much because of an issue. He had already gone through enough.
Al had.
Yes.
Yeah. He'd been tortured through that.
He had been already tortured. And I'm in this situation where I have 4 kids. I am their mother, and my job is to secure my children's interest and my children's cousins. I mean, there's no way I can leave them behind either.
Mm-hmm.
They're just as valuable and precious. And then you go to your neighbor's kids, and you know what I mean? It's like you have a responsibility to your community, to your children's cousins, to your family, and then your community. And that was my job. And which is something I never did before. I never went against my husband. I mean, I always kind of stayed in a little circle that he kind of kept me enclosed in, because there's a lot of certain things he didn't, he just, anyway, there were some things I did not do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I went ahead and did them anyway, and he knew it, because I was not going to do that. And, but anyway, basically, though, I kind of stayed in, but he wanted nothing to do with that. And Kay was coming down at the invitation because she met Al Starr at the Indian Rights Association meeting. Al happened to be in Fairbanks at a time when the Indian Rights Association meeting was meeting, and Kay was at that meeting giving the Indian Rights meeting that information about her thesis. Mm-hmm. She gave a talk. And that's when Al Starr invited her to come down to talk to Ninana, which, like I say, it took time because we had to create a forum for him to talk to, for us to get permission to use the Native Hall. Uh-huh.
Okay.
It has to stand on firm ground. You have to do a procedure. So Kay came down and gave that talk. And it was almost over when a couple of guys come in, one from Minto, but he's married to, I think, a Dot Lake or Tanacross woman. Robert Charlie was married to a Tanacross woman, but he's reside in Minto, but yet he married a Tanacross woman and lived with her, but yet he was coming in from Tanacross with Lawrence David. And Lawrence David is from that region. They were coming in because they were going to Minto, probably for the holidays or something. I'm not sure why Robert would be traveling at that time. But he happened to see the lights on at the Native Hall, and he came in toward the end of the talk, and him and Lawrence David, and listened in. And of course, Minto has always kind of had and been an aware and conscious of land issues, unresolved. They are always aware of it. They grew up in it. Not that there was any activity going on, but they were aware that they had some kind of documentation of keeping their land. And anyhow, after the talk that Kay gave, she asked, she wanted questions from the floor, and she heard, you know, of people losing a trap line here to the Clear Basin and hunting grounds and, you know, all of, anyway, she was astounded at what was going on. And she said, well, do you think any other villages would be interested? And I said, well, maybe Minto. And, you know, Robert Charlie was there. Well, Robert, do you think Minto? And he said, yeah, they would be interested. And so it was planned at that time, because Robert was heading to Minto, and he, you know, we talked it over when you'd think Minto could come and meet. And, you know, we selected a date, February, somewhere in February, and we would have Minto, Kay would come down again for a meeting, and Kay would meet with Minto and Ninana people, okay? Well, that meeting happened in February, and Kay also had Mary Alice Miller come down, and also coming down was Tom Snapp, a reporter, at that meeting.
Do you know who Mary Alice Miller is?
No, I was going to ask who Mary Alice Miller is. I know who Tom
Mary
Snapp
Alice,
is.
Judge Mary Alice Miller. State. Judge Mary Alice Miller.
There was a female judge?
A female judge named Mary Alice Miller came and sat in on the whole thing.
Okay. And you said she was a friend of Charlie's? Yeah. Okay.
Well, I don't know if she's a friend of Charlie's. Kay is the one that brought her down.
But,
mean, I'd have no idea, hon, about that. See, it could be. Maybe he'd been before
I've not
her.
Heard
I don't know.
I've not heard her name, so that's interesting.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
She's a pivotal point to what she's
Well, doing. Anyway, let me tell the rest of the story, because after it was all over, Minto brought their little paperwork, handful of paperwork here, handful there, had their okay after, and then they were left, and Kay turns to Mary Alice, and she said, well, Mary Alice, what do you think? And Mary Alice says, I think you have a case. Whew! Mm-hmm. It was like electricity through us. Absolutely electrified us. Oh my God, we have validity. And So that meeting is, well, do you think there's other villages that would be involved? Da-da-da-da. Well, yeah. Well, we'll have it in March. And that is when we sent out notices, probably 20, 30 or notices to more surrounding villages. And that is when 9 villages come to the third meeting. Mm-hmm. And addressing the letters. And even, I think we had to write them in longhand. I'm not quite sure about all of
them. Some of them are in your dad's collection at the archives. There are copies of those types of letters.
Okay, well, anyhow.
Because yeah, I've seen them.
Yeah, I'm the one that brought, right, that okay. was from my dad's stuff.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what dad's stuff that didn't get burned. I think.
No, it's a copy.
Yeah, it is. They need to be organized in years. You know,
anyway, I know the letters you're talking about.
The bottom line is that it was the chief's wife, Mary Domenoff, who addressed a lot of that wonderful. If you see some wonderful longhand, that was Mary Domenoff's writing. Mm-hmm. Anyhow.
But you wrote the letters. And
I don't remember writing those letters of inviting them to that meeting. I don't remember writing those letters. I'm not sure if they, I hate to think that they got longhand written. They must have been typed. Somebody must have typed.
I think the ones I've seen, I think were typed.
Okay, I might have done the typing.
I can tell, and, I can tell
but
you because I have my
I do know Mary's the one that sent them out.
She sent them, huh?
And that's when we met at Frank Alexander's house for that meeting.
Now, was that the first meeting in 1962?
No.
No, this is before that.
Before that. Oh.
This is in Nenana, meeting. The chief's meeting was called. And at that meeting is the Minto,
decided there.
That's when Minto brought up the fact of Nuchilawoya is the traditional meeting site.
Right, and that's when you...
And that is when, okay, we do Minto.
And that's when the...
We do Tanana.
Yeah,
is when we had the big gathering.
June of 1962.
And that's when Robert Bennett, the BIA guy, came. Because Kennedy had sent up a delegation to, you're going to have to ask your dad precisely what that was. They sent 2 big books out of that. And that's, like I say, that meeting was crucial at that time because they came to it. But Kennedy had sent up Robert Bennett, was Oneida.
No, that wasn't Robert Bennett. It was Bill Keeler. Is that who you're talking
maybe.
About?
Maybe. Oh, God. Bill Keeler, maybe?
There was
okay. Okay, maybe it was.
There was
maybe
a task. It was called the Task Force on Alaska Native Affairs.
Yeah. Bill Keeler.
Bill Keeler.
Okay.
He was the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation.
Oh, well, no.
Hugh Wade, Secretary of State for Alaska. And yeah. James Officer, Associate Commissioner of Indian Affairs. That's what I have.
Okay.
Could be wrong.
No.
But that's what I have for that group.
You've gone through Ted Hetzel's, pictures. Have you ever?
No, I haven't seen those.
Okay, because he.
He was there
too.
His family gave me all the photographs. Ted Hetzel. I think he was. He's a professional topographer, and he primarily focused on Native American.
Okay.
A very famous.
Of those photos that we have in the archives from you
that I gave to the university.
Right, but were those Ted's photos or those?
Yeah, a lot of them were Ted's.
Okay, yeah, I have his name, but he was part of the Indian Rights Association.
Right. He was part of the Indian Rights, which was a Red Man organization. He was part of an organization. It was a nationwide group called the Red Man.
Oh, and that was the
same
as...
Some say it's a precursor of the Boy Scouts. I don't know. I mean, I've heard that rumor before, but...
But was that the same as the Indian Rights Association or something different?
Yeah, well, the Indian Rights is probably an association on American Indian Affairs, huh? Yeah, there was a connection.
It's a national organization. There was the Association of American Indian Affairs, which was Laverne Madigan and Henry Forbes.
Time, she came out.
And then I have this Indian Rights Association with Ted's name.
Right.
And then there's the Alaska Native Rights Association.
Okay, that was
which was
then.
Kay and Charlie
right.
and
yep.
Grant Newman and Sandy Jensen.
Sandy Jensen.
That's what I have.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but this, when your mom comes back, this third meeting in Nenana with the nine villages, what year that was? She said it was in March. But
yeah, it was March, April, 60.
Was it 61?
Yeah, probably in 61 or they.
Maybe your dad remembers, because I know the big chiefs conference in Tanana was in 62.
It was in June of 62.
62. Yeah. And so when this March meeting, was it the same year or was it?
Yeah,
say,
she should be able to remember that.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I was six.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I know you were
six.
You were around, but you were a kid,
right.
So how much you would remember about it. But, you know, certainly kids remember way more than we realize, I think. You absorb things, probably. You don't even realize it.
So
that meeting in Nenana, how early was that? Was it 61 or 62?
That March.
Well,
Hayes,
is all that same year.
It was a year. Okay, so it was in 62. Then.
Right, so that March meeting was March of 62.
Yeah, it's before Tanana.
And then Tanana was in June of 62. It was the same year. Okay.
I mean, God, I don't know how we did all that.
I don't, that's, yeah, how
and
did
okay,
you do all
this
that?
This is, again, we got to back up because, like I say, the crucial woman, of course, there was Kay, but Sandy Jensen came on board and did so much also. And these are two widow women. Again, people who had, I mean, Kay was in desperate states. I mean, she had a teenage son. She'd widowed. She had to put herself through school, and I don't know how she afforded it. It must have been a student loan or something. I don't know, in order to get a job as a teacher, you know, professor of English, to support herself. And she's an orphan. She'd been raised in an orphanage. Sandy Jensen was a widow who, of course, had homesteaded up here, which is on the corner of where the university owns it now. They acquired, I think it's the university, during the pipeline years. They bought out her homestead and her daughter's. They filed next to each other. Dittman was the daughter's name, Nancy Dittman, I think, and Sandy Jensen.
So what was Sandy's role when getting involved with you guys?
Maybe I'm jumping ahead. She might not have been involved prior, but I know she...
But when she got involved, what did
she
do?
Well, mostly in helping, in the coordinating of communicating from Nenana to the Fairbanks people.
Okay.
She's coordinated and kept whatever. And then Kay is the one... Oh, God, now we got to get back up, okay? No, we don't. We can move forward. Because around that time, okay, yeah. Now we're talking about the rest of Alaska a little bit, hon. Because crucial time, everything, you know, you got this vast land, and this is happening in this little bubble down here, which is Nenana, Minto, and Fairbanks, and, you know, and then, of course, it goes to Tanana and gets started.
Holy Cross.
And so anyhow, then... At the time, our great white leaders is deciding it was a brilliant idea. William Wood, Dr. William Wood, to make a bomb, a...
Oh, Project Chariot.
Yeah, exactly. A harbor in Point Hope.
Right.
And the people at Point Hope are mortified. And way over here in New York... is Howard Rock.
Noticing.
And he is an artist that has been discovered by the Association of American Indian Affairs.
Laverne Madigan.
Laverne Madigan.
And I don't know exactly why they would pull him in, but anyway, he was an artist, I guess you'd say, in residence out there. And so the people at Point Hope don't know what to do, who to go to. They contacted Howard and informed him what's going on, what can be done. And Howard, thank God, was out there in the New York headquarters office, little office. I mean, New York City's got gazillion offices. And he's this artist in residence. He's, I think, working on his big picture of a polar bear at that time. He made a big picture. Anyhow, and he informs Laverne of this going on. And of course, she investigates, you know. And of course, our transformation of information, you know, before Facebook and all this stuff, I don't know how and what kind of avenue she used to verify what the heck the U.S. is thinking about, and William Wood and all of these, whoever the great thinkers, which you'd have to look at the firecracker book
right.
to find out who were the brains behind this. And anyhow, she found out, you know, there was some validity into this, and she and Howard flew up here just prior to our Tanana Chiefs meeting. It was after the March meeting. Howard and Laverne and Guy Akakuk and Kay. Now Laverne was in the hospital because she broke her arm. I remember going to see her on that trip. Somehow she broke her arm. And I remember Kay and Guy Akakuk and Howard Rock coming to our cabin. And I remember Kay whispering to me, maybe we can get some financial help from an outfit called the Association of American Indian Affairs. And oh, wow, because we had no money. Nobody had money. Nobody in those days had money. I don't even know how we did what we did even in those days. But anyhow, and then before land claim, I mean, before the meeting, we learned that association, I think if I remember right, contributed $800 toward airfare or something. Mm-hmm.
To bring people to Tanana?
To Tanana, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was Wayne Charter.
Mm-hmm.
And they also printed up the flyers.
Because I remember Senator Stevens telling me that, well, Charlie reminded me to ask Senator Stevens, but Senator Stevens donated some money for the airplane charter himself. Mm-hmm. He was a local attorney.
Oh, he was still a, he wasn't senator
no,
yet.
No,
no, no.
Way before.
No.
I was gonna say, did he come
well,
to
he,
the...
he was just no, a, he was an attorney up here.
Yeah. No, he didn't
right.
come to the meeting, no.
And him and Charlie, there's a long story called the horse story that goes, predates any of this too, which is a whole other story. But, and the reason I'm bringing it up, because my son, Owen, before... you know, Senator Stevens got real old or whatever, but it was probably past the 90s. It was past the 90s. My brother was at an event at Alaska Land that, you know, he Senator Stevens would have a hot dog or
oh, right, right.
Yeah, type thing.
Yeah.
And so my brother went up and introduced himself that he's Denali Purvis and Charlie Purvis's son, and Senator Stevens said he'll never forget Charlie Purvis. And that's because of the horse story, which is a whole nother story. But anyway.
The small world.
Do you have copies of the Tanana Chiefs minutes of the 62 meeting?
In the collection, there's certainly...
Because I've given them to the university. But
yeah, there's certainly a lot of information. related to that meeting. I can't tell you if there's the exact.
And I also have minutes of the 63 meeting as well.
Yeah, there's the program, and the 63 meeting is, how do you say that?
Dananahanesh.
There's information about that as well. So, yeah, I have to look through my notes afterwards and see if what we have copies of and what we know. I mean, it's a great collection of showing about that time period.
Because I have, for 10 years, probably about every 100 times, that's been published too, which I don't think the university's got.
No, the Tundra Times collection is up in Utqiagvik, and it's on a website.
Oh, it is.
And it's searchable, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
So that's been well cataloged and protected.
Yeah, because a lot of that was, you know, during the flood of 67, a lot of that Newsminer and Tom Snapp's stuff disappeared.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's a complete collection, but it is. And then sometimes, you know,
Colleen.
Yeah, I know Colleen Redman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. And that's another project. So, and there's also in archival collections, often, you know, people like you have a copy of a newspaper article and it's in the folder. And so there's also sometimes those carry forth as well. Well,
I think it was a 63 meeting that, you know, Tana Chiefs, you know, through, you know, their resolution process, their directive process, so, you know, decided it was time to start a statewide organization.
Now we start
statewide organization.
Oh. Or at least a statewide movement.
Yeah. Well, you know, kind of the creation of AFN.
Well, AFN didn't officially become...
They didn't have that word AFN then.
Go beyond the local issue.
Okay. Yeah, they were reaching out. Well, even I think it was definitely by the second chief's meeting. I remember sending out and him responding even to Pribilov's. Gromanov was his last name. I can't remember his first name, but somehow I got the address of Gromanov inviting him to the meeting. And he sent a letter back that he'd love to come, but his bishop, he was a priest, Gromanov was a priest, and the bishop wouldn't let him. And the bishop, of course, was a Russian Orthodox. He's a Russian man, a bishop in Russia. And of course, at that time, the Russian Orthodox was trying to survive under a communist system. And I think they didn't want to ruffle any feathers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I do see here in the collection my notes about there was a petition signed in the 63 saying, requesting a freeze of state land selections.
Right.
That came out of the 62 chiefs meeting. So that's what you're saying, that resolution, it was some kind of a petition that it looks like
Secretary of Interior.
Yeah, but that they circulated amongst villages to ask them to sign it. Because there's a copy of this is another thing, that there was sent out a form to the village councils to have them select delegates to come to the Athabaskan conference. And I don't know, that would have been in 63?
Well, also now we sent letters out to have them file blanket claims. That was crucial. And that data came from Laverne Madigan. How to make and file. Essential thing we had to do was file blanket claims and letting the state know, asserting this land is ours. You can have what we don't file, you know. And I know the BLM guy who was BLM, I can't think of his name now, but Roger could probably help me with it because he went to Cornell. He was a Cornellian. But he said that at BLM, they were surprised at the blanket claims, at how how well defined they knew their own borders. And they very seldom crossed over, or if one crossed over, they yielded to the other one. There was no conflict.
So the different villages filed
everybody had to file a blanket claim. Everybody had to file a blanket claim.
That said, this
and
is
that
our...
is Laverne Madigan that came out of, yes, yeah, we had to send letters out to get the blanket claim.
Maybe that's what those petitions were.
Yeah, yeah, it could be.
So that was Laverne's idea.
Well, it's what had to be done. Okay. Actually, it got stolen from us. That letter got stolen from Howard Rock's office. And we know who did it, but, you know, the man's dead and can't talk for himself. And he gave it to the news miner. And the news miner, of course, at the... This is after the first land claims meeting. Of course, the news miner called us communist. And in those days, that's a very serious...
Right.
Very serious.
Yeah, you haven't gotten that daily news miner stuff yet to read what they were saying.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to that level of detail.
But anyhow, like I say,
I'm sure. But, I mean, newspaper research is an amazing resource. Yeah.
But in the meanwhile, this here, like I say, we'd been already called communists. And anyway, there's a lot there that I had. And anyway, yeah. This letter got stolen, brought to the news miner, and they published it in their editorial page as a, this is what they're sending out to the villages. I mean, they couldn't have done better publicity. I mean, hon, it is one of the funniest. I mean, this is a warning, this is what they're sending to the villages, and here it was free publicity for me.
Well, that makes me want to go find that. So that would have been 63, maybe? 62, 63?
I'm not sure, 62, 63. In that era, we had to file land claims.
So why did...
Blanket claims, I mean.
Why did you need to do blanket claims?
To identify what... Here is the line. You can have what we don't claim. This is our land. This is the declaration. This is our land, even though we're not recognized by... In fact, see, we were not even recognized. Oh, God, let's see. Okay. When Kay sent the letter to the Secretary of Interior, informing them that there's unresolved Aboriginal land claims up here. Of course, their response is, you know, that court of claims thing that had to be submitted by 51. And other after that, no Aboriginal claims would be honored or recognized.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And then number one and number two is that they wouldn't do one of two things. They would not do reservation system because they were just pockets of poverty, and they would not do individual settlements, you know, like cash settlement, you know, individual,
right.
Because then they're accused of destroying the tribe. And Charlie happened to be at that meeting, and he said, well, call it corporation. Do a corporation. It's the same thing as a tribe. And that grabbed people. The young natives did not want to be a chief. They wanted to be presidents. And also, they also were aware of tribal law. And hun, do you understand tribal law?
No. Does anybody understand tribal law?
Let me explain.
It's so complicated.
Let me explain the royal head of Britain. That's tribal law. The king and the queen. The House of Sayud. Total tribal law. They own everything. They own everything.
Right.
They own the whole of Saudi Arabia. They own your house because they provided that house. If someone does something wrong, yes, there must be punishment, but they won't die. You will. Someone will have to die, but it don't have to be the one if it is the royal house that ordered the irregularity. And in Britain, had modified their tribal law by rudiment when those nobles met and said, you're going to share the power. That was a historic occasion, because then it spread not only from the royal house to the nobles. And then later on, of course, they cut off of the king's heads. And then now they have the House of Commons. And these became, of course, I got to back up way a little more, because common law originated Alexander the Great. If it was not for him, we would, that is the difference between Western law and Eastern law. Mm-hmm. If Japan won, they'd have your house and your head or your whatever. If Japan won the war, Western world won. Japan has their house, they have their government, they have their land. It's a whole different concept, and we got that from the Persians.
Yes.
When Alexander the Great went in there and conquered Persia, they conquered Alexander the Great.
Yep.
And that is so powerful. And these are things that Americans don't understand. Laws that were made hundreds of years ago, policy made hundreds of years ago, are in play. They're the rules today.
Yes, definitely.
But they are not being followed in today's world. It's swept under the rug.
Well, and that's
whatever.
The thing is getting people to go against those laws, which is what land claims did.
But no, you're with them laws.
Yeah. Well, that was the basis.
If it was not for them, we would not have a leg to stand on.
Mm-hmm.
That is the law.
Right.
It is.
Right. I see what you mean.
I
just want to ask one question, follow up. You said they would not do reservations and not do individual cash settlements. Who is
capital,
they?
Per capita.
Right.
The U.S. government.
That was the government's position.
Yeah, was the Interior, Secretary of Interior. Right.
Okay. I want to make sure that was their position, not the native community's position.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, you know, the meeting with Wickersham as well is, you know, that was still very memorized in the Native community that they said, no, we don't want reservations.
Right.
Alfred Starr, when he was in the Lower 48 traveling around doing his own investigation of Native American law, and he went to a number of what he described hell holes. They were just, he said, no way do we want reservations to be in Alaska.
Right.
But he did want the land.
Right. But land claims was a way to get the land without doing reservations. What other options were there?
Right.
And that's what you guys
now,
were working
on. Now, would it be secured?
On.
What would be the mechanism to?
Right. Mm-hmm. And so you've been talking for a long time, and you may be tired, and whether we stop and I come back another day and we keep going.
Well, it's
I volunteer on
Bear
Tuesdays
has to go.
With the Salvation Army.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a good time to take. I have no idea what time. I don't have a clock up here.
It's 1:30.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
So, oh my God, then you gotta go. Yeah. Why don't we fold it up?
Yeah, and then I'll come back.
There's a lot of other points that that she should have made on the way.
Right.
We can discuss, and I can
Yeah, I was trying not to interrupt too much.
Yeah.
Because what you say is all wonderful context and background and is very important. But yeah, I have follow-up questions and
Well,
you know,
like
you kept saying, "Oh, you're jumping ahead." Well,
yeah, well, like I say, we got there a step at a time.
Right.
And we got this one was over here and found something and then had to splice it in.
That's how history works.
I mean,
that's how life works.
I mean, it was, and like I say, working under, there was no road from Nenana to Fairbanks.
Right. And that's where you have to go give the backstory before
you know, for my dad and Al Starr used to walk on the railroad and meet each other halfway.
Yeah.
I mean, this was work.
Right.
I mean,
so I agree that there's all those details to kind of backtrack
and
go through.
I mean, you're focusing on kind of the beginnings of it, right?
Right.
Right. So, well, that's kind of what you wanted to
know. Stories, you know, pretty much right up until it was signed.
No,
in
71. I know, but
and there's, you know, like Don Wright.
Right.
You know, I don't know. Have you ever gotten a story that he knew Richard Nixon back in the early 60s?
I haven't looked into that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it came down to when Don was lobbying. He was head of AFN at the time,
right.
And he was back in Washington. He brought his little business card of Senator Nixon.
Oh.
And Nixon wrote an order, "Come visit me anytime you're in Washington." So he went to the White House, and his daughter's got it well documented,
right.
Darlene. But so he gave it to the security guard, him and another person that was with Don. And to his friend's surprise, the security guard came out 2 minutes later and said, "The president will see you." So he went back and visited Nixon, and Nixon said, "Don, you get the legislation, get a bill in front of me, I'm going to sign it. I support the American Indian."
Yeah,
and
well,
the natives.
And Nixon, he was big on, he had a whole Indian policy.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And he gave
and
this great speech,
with it, if you ever read his book.
Yeah, so he was definitely.
His coach was a American.
Right.
American.
That's right. And so he was definitely supportive. I mean, the Angus story has been...
And, of course,
so
that's the
pieces.
Quaker connection.
Right. Well, that's another thing to
and
ask
that
about.
And that K is
and
a Quaker.
Right. So I'm going to turn
so
this off.
Charlie Purvis
and Charlie Purvis
the States
is
to
a
Quaker.
Oh, okay.
Not a Quaker. I mean, see, Charlie is a universalist.
Right.
And
well,
he could be a Quaker,
be
anything.
I had this whole list of questions
okay.
exactly about those kinds of things. I'm going to turn this off.